a great service already. Those of you that are visiting or may not be aware that our preaching arrangement is a little different from many congregations. We have a rotation of five or so men that speak on Sunday mornings, made up of some of our elders and deacons. And the advantage of that is to get different points of view and to have different men thinking about the needs of the teaching that's done. The disadvantage is you may not get the highest quality as a man that preaches every single Sunday. And I'm certainly aware of that as I prepare to speak. I sometimes think that I'm getting four or five weeks between each sermon. And I ought to be able to come up with something better than this, but I'll do the best I can. And hopefully that the fact that it's a study from God's Word will be of use. Also to the visitors, tolerate us just for a minute. There's something we need to take care of as a family. For the last few weeks, we've been looking out from among ourselves men that would meet the qualifications to serve as deacons of this congregation. The elders now would like to present to the group and take this moment to do that. Four men who have been mentioned in many, many of the inputs that we received. And we stop and give praise to everyone who turned in an input. The inputs were, there were many of them. They were well thought out. And we appreciate that participation. But these four men, Miles Brubaker, Michael Parker, Jason McElvain, and Danny Engel, have been mentioned by many of those forms that were turned in. And we would like for you to consider these men as if they would be qualified to be deacons. What we'd like to do is have a period of consideration, really just a week. We'd like to really only give about a week to do this. But think about these men, their wives, their ability to management of their families, and consider whether they are qualified in your eyes or not. If they're not in some way, or perhaps there's some way in which they need to develop further, that's something that you could talk to them about personally, or if you're not comfortable with that, the elders would be glad to help you with that and discuss that with you privately to help these men to know where they might not be qualified or might need further development. But we'd like to put about a week deadline on that, and then probably in a couple of weeks from today, we'll take that time to appoint these men to be deacons, given that there are not any objections that can't be dealt with. I would also say that it's so encouraging to see these inputs and the large number of men who have been listed, many men listed by lots of the members here. You just have to think of the future here with these men that are qualifying themselves, who are setting an example, managing their family, growing in the Word, and it really bodes well for the future of the work here and speaks highly of those men who are beginning to qualify themselves for that. Okay, to our sermon this morning. We are spending a year, which we're calling A Year with Jesus, began back in September. What we would like to do is spend some time each week, and we have been assigning readings for each of the families to spend their devotional time with. And I, looking ahead to this date, looked to see what the reading was, and it was from Matthew chapter 14. And looking at Matthew 14, I thought, well, I'd like to make a lesson out of something like that, perhaps to tie in with the studies that are going on, the readings that we're each of us doing individually, following through in the life of Jesus. In Matthew 14 is the feeding of the 5,000, a very familiar story, and that's the lesson that's on the devotionals. There's a little half sheet for family devotions back on the table. David's keeping those up to date. And that's the study for this week, so take one of those and take a look at it. The reading this morning, however, came from the first part of chapter 14, where there is a description of an incident with Herod. On the surface, it's just an incident describing the popularity of Jesus that had been so widely known that it came to the ears of Herod, who at the first hearing of it thought, well, this must be John the Baptist. I don't think I've ever heard a lesson. I shouldn't say that. I don't think I remember hearing a lesson just on Herod Antipas. But I'd like to do that this morning. Perhaps in your study you can meditate a little further on the character of this man. In recent weeks we've had lessons on Jesus as an example to young men, on Mary as an example to young women. We haven't even had a lesson on Korah about what is a rebel, I think last Sunday night. This is another negative example. Almost negative to the extreme. It's very hard to find anything good about Herod Antipas, and yet there is lessons to be learned about sin and its consequences, which I hope will live with us. This is an actual photograph taken in just a coin, actually, apparently with his image on it. But I'd like to talk about this Herod Antipas. In the story that's told in Matthew 14 and also in Mark 6, and to be clear, I'll probably take more details from Mark 14 because there's more said there. Strangely enough, in Mark's account, which is shorter overall, there's more said about Herod Antipas and about this event. What happens is the popularity of Jesus has reached a point where the news comes to Herod. He immediately thinks that John the Baptist is risen from the dead. So this is a strange order of events in a way. The story begins and John the Baptist is already dead, has already had his head cut off and delivered on the platter. And that's the gruesome way this text ends with that event. But to explain that, both Mark and Matthew go back in time and say, well, how come Herod thought this was John the Baptist? Well, because he killed him. Well, why did he kill him? Well, it's because his wife wanted him killed. Well, what gave her the opportunity? Well, he had a birthday party and he made an oath. Well, why did he do that? Because his stepdaughter danced. Well, what made John to be available for that request? Well, he put him in jail. Why did he put him in jail? So the story has to be kind of backed all the way up in the text. And so it's a little bit of a flashback. So I'd like to kind of do that this morning, talk about a little bit of the history of Herod and what leads us up to these events and what lessons we can learn. Herod Antipas is the one of the many sons of one of the many wives of Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the Herod that killed the babies at the time that Jesus was born. Herod Antipas was not much of a man or a ruler or a husband in many ways. And if you actually see the family tree of Herod the Great, you'll find that a lot of the cousins and so on married each other. So not a lot really to admire even about the way this family grew. Herod the Great had five wives that are shown across the top there. The son of one of those wives was Herod Philip. And he married Herodias, which is in the lower circle there, lower oval. And another wife of Herod the Great gave birth to Herod Antipas, who is the Herod we'll be talking about today. Herod Philip married Herodias, which would have been his niece or something, or step-niece or something like that. A lot of that in that family. And at some point, we learn from historians, Josephus in particular has a good bit to say about Herod Antipas and his character. At some point, Herod Antipas, who was married to someone else, made a trip to Rome and there met Herodias, who was quite ambitious. And she saw in Herod Antipas a much more of an opportunity, perhaps, speculation, for affluence and power than she saw in her current husband, Herod Philip. She must have been in some way attractive because they eloped or ran off and were married, and then Herod Antipas set about to divorce his wife, who was a daughter of a nearby ruler in another area. The result of that was the daughter of this ruler that whom he divorced went back home, and there was a war, and he actually suffered some defeats militarily as a result of having divorced her. But a good bit of treachery there in taking the wife of his half-brother Philip. That sets the stage for the kind of character this guy was. He's called a tetrarch, and I'm not sure exactly what a tetrarch is. I just know it's not a king. He basically had been given a few areas to rule, Galilee in particular, and some of the area across on the eastern side of Jordan. This is Herod Antipas. And so he had somewhat of a title during this period of time. His life was full of evil. Luke describes him this way early in the book of Luke. When John rebuked Herod the tetrarch because of Herodias, his brother's wife, and all the other evil things he had done. So before that incident with his brother's wife, there were plenty of other things that Herod Antipas would have been guilty of. And Herod added this to them all, that he locked John up in prison. That's Luke's account early in the book of Luke. About a year ago, we studied the story of John the Baptist, those men that he sent to talk to Jesus. It's found in Luke chapter 7. And Herod plays a little bit of a role in that story, but we'll not talk so much about that today. We'll look closely at the character of Herod. So that's where we are. And then in the beginning of the book of... So you see the first thing about his character is by his taking of the wife, he was driven by his passions to immorality, and as we'll see in the story, many more things. But what I want to do as we go through and look at Herod and the facts about him is collect some facts about sin and its consequences. I think the first thing we notice is when a person is merely driven by their passions, there really are no rules that they are not willing to break eventually. here's a case where there was treachery against the wife that he had, a broken oath, the example set as a ruler in the kingdom. All those things were swept aside because, in today's language, he fell in love. He fell in love with Herodias. How often do we just set aside the rules of good conduct, even the rules that Gentiles would understand, even the basis people would understand, just in the name of romance or some type of a sexual attraction? I think the arguments today for homosexuality and for this idea of not staying together as married people if you're no longer compatible is, well, we're just in love. And somehow that excuses every other kind of treachery or dishonesty or poor example setting. And I think when we are driven by our lusts or our passions, there really is no limit to what we might do with regard to following those desires. And so in the book of Mark, and I'll use that, Mark then goes back to give the history of why it is that Herod is thinking that Jesus is John the Baptist risen from the dead. And he gives this background. Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Notice they were married. Not appropriate to be married. It was an adulterous marriage, and yet they're declared to be married. But he arrested John for the sake of his wife, Herodias. Because John had said to Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Therefore, Herodias held it against him, that is, against John the Baptist. Held it against, an interesting Greek word. I think literally it almost means had it in for him. In the English words, we know what that means. She was out to get him. And she was going to use Herod himself to get that done. And wanted to kill him, but she could not. And then I'll go back to the book of Matthew, and here's another statement that's made. And although he wanted to put him to death, and that's Herod himself wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet. You see all these forces at work in Herod's thinking? Here's his wife that he is attracted to for some reason, somehow, and she's putting the pressure on him. Here's this criticism of John the Baptist that perhaps is embarrassing him publicly. He'd like to get that out of the way. Get that man quiet. Stop that. There's the multitude that really, apparently, it respects John. And there's pressure that he would upset the multitude if he killed him. Perhaps there's his own conscience that says, you know what, this really wasn't the right thing to do because he could see that he was a prophet or that he had some. But he resented the rebuke. And I think that's typical of sinful people. When you go to them and say, you know, this isn't right, the first reaction is to say, you have no right to tell me. I'm my own person. I'll live my own life. And there's anger that comes from that. Book of Proverbs talks about whoever corrects a mocker invites insult. Whoever rebukes a wicked man incurs abuse. Do not rebuke a mocker or he will hate you. Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. Instruct a wise man, he will be wiser still. Teach a righteous man and he will add to his learning. So the second thing we notice about Herod is he did not like the rebuke. And of course, under the influence of his wife Herodias, arrested John and put him in prison as a result of that criticism. How often do we sometimes shoot the messenger, as they say, when something has to be said to rebuke us for our... But Herod feared John, Mark says, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man. He kept him safe. This to me is an interesting conflict in Herod's mind. In fact, read on, he says, when he heard him, apparently Herod heard John the Baptist on occasion, he was greatly perplexed and yet heard him gladly. If you're reading out of the New King James, you'll find this word greatly perplexed. It doesn't read that way at all. It says, and he did many things. I don't know. Apparently one little change of letter in the Greek and it says, and he did many things. But the actual Greek seems like the most sensible reading, the one that has the most textual basis behind it, really says that he went many ways, which is, at first doesn't explain a lot either. But if you think about it, that's really what was happening in Herod's thinking, wasn't it? He was pulled one way by Herodias. He was pulled another way by the multitude. He was pulled one way by this desire to silence the messenger. He was pulled another way by his own conscience and his fear of John. And so the translators take that he was pulled many ways, or did many ways, is what it says, and translate that properly, I think. He didn't know what to do. He was greatly perplexed. He was pulled in every direction. We can almost draw a picture this way. Here's poor Herod in the middle, and there's Herodias influencing him, and there's this convenience to silence his criticism. But on the other hand, there's the multitudes. There's John, who he saw was a holy man, and there was this pleasure as well. He actually gladly heard him. The word gladly there suggests he heard him with pleasure. He kind of enjoyed going to hear what John the Baptist had to say. Not that he did anything about it, but it was a curiosity, something that entertained him a good bit. Here's another consequence of sin. He was driven by conflicting worldly influences, not by a single-minded desire to do right. You know how that works in our life? Is we have this financial concern and this stressing item here and this piece of guilt in our life over here. And all of those things just fill up our minds with all these confusing things, and we don't know what to do. But stop and think. Wasn't it pretty clear what the right thing to do with regard to John the Baptist was? The one voice, which is just do the right thing. He's innocent and you're not, and take care of that. That voice is not present at all. And I think about what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount when in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 20. He says, 22, the lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? The idea of having a single eye is really the way this word is translated. Not just good or bad, but a single eye. What Herod lacked was one voice, the voice of what's the right thing to do. And in the absence of that, every other kind of influence just becomes more and more confusing and louder and louder. He lacked the single guiding force in his life. Keep going. Then an opportune day. The word opportune means a good day. A good day came. It actually has the Greek root for good in it. It wasn't good for John the Baptist. It really wasn't good for anybody, but it was good for what Herodias wanted to do. An opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, "Ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you." He also swore to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give you," and Mark adds here, "up to half of my kingdom." Let's look at this a little bit. It says Herodias' daughter herself. There's something interesting in that wording. This kind of dancing for the pleasure of men, probably drunken men, at a banquet like this, was not something that a noble person would do. I think that's the intent of saying herself. That's something that maybe the lowest kind of a person would do, to come in for entertainment and entertain these men. And yet, this stepdaughter of Herod came in at Herod's invitation, apparently, certainly with his permission. And as she danced, probably in a seductive way, that began to have a power over him. And once again, a man driven by his lust was almost just swept away to do a stupid thing. He just did a foolish thing. Isn't that the way sin works? And our lust drives us. We even do more and more foolish things. And now, even more complications arise as a result of that. He was driven by lust to foolish decisions. What's even so foolish about this is, he is not a king. He has no right to give away half of his kingdom. And you just wonder, what is he thinking? Maybe he's bragging with all these chief officers of his army and everything that are there. And he said, up to half of my kingdom. He can't give that away. In fact, it'll eventually be taken from him. He ends his life in exile because he got on the wrong side of the Caesar. But he brags and says he can do that. How often is it that we're just carried away by our lust to even more foolish decisions than we would have made otherwise? With regard to sexual temptation in particular, you have to think of the Proverbs. The lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. So there's this seduction. But where does it take us? Notice what the Proverbs writer says. He says, keep a path far from her door. Do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your best strength to others, your years to the one who is cruel. Strangers will feast on your wealth, and your toil will enrich another man's house. At the end of your life, you will groan. We'll read later that Herod's going to be exceedingly sorry. Use the book of Mark's account. When your flesh and body are spent, you'll say, how I hated discipline, how my heart spurned correction. There's so many of these the power of sin gets a hold of us, and it leads us to more and more foolish decisions and more complications in our lives. You can't help but think of the book of Romans. It says, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slave whom you obey, whether of sin to death or of obedience to righteousness? in our life, the farther down we go in following the passions, the less and less control we have over things. And more complicated things will be, and the more foolish our decision-making will be. Well, let's see how this turned out. So he offered her up to half of his kingdom. So she went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask?" And she said, "The head of John the Baptist." She knew the answer. Herodias was ready for this. Perhaps, some think, she arranged this whole thing knowing that that's the kind of thing he would say, and she could take advantage of this for a favor. Immediately. The language in Mark often is this idea of how quickly things happen. She was ready. And immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist," and as an added touch, on a platter, here in front of all these men, to show how you were able to do this. The king was exceedingly sorry. This isn't what Herod wanted to happen. And yet, because of oaths, because of those who sat with him, and he did not want to refuse her. So now, look at the complications in his life. Now new influences. Not just the pressure of Herodias, but now Salome herself. That's Herodias' daughter. Not just the convenience, but also because these important guests have seen him make this bragging promise. And he took an oath. And now these pressures on the left side, pushing him to do the wrong thing, finally overwhelm what he knew to be right. You can see those powers growing in his life. Just learn, this is the lesson. Past sins and a string of poor decisions, they don't ever get better. And they eventually create unsolvable dilemmas. I'll just say, when you talk to someone who for a long time in their life have been engaged in some type of a sin or following their passions or made a long series of very bad, poor decisions. Have you had this experience? I have. There's just not a good answer. What am I supposed to do about this? Well, do I break my oath that I made in front of all these people? Or do I just go cut John the Baptist's head off? You see, I mean, it's one of these where, see, there's no way for him to do right in that situation. No. The sin of his past life and the foolishness of his present decision-making has led him to a place where he really has no good answers. That's the way sin leads us. And that's the evidence in Herod Antipas' life. More and more influence is taking to a place that he can't handle. Immediately the king sent an executioner, commanded his head to be brought, and he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter, gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. And when his disciples heard of it, they came and took away his corpse and laid it in the tomb. There really were no good choices to be made. Now, remember, this is not the end of the story. This all happened before the story that's in this text. This is in Herod's mind. And maybe it's 6-12 months later that he hears about these things that are happening in his territory or in the area of Galilee. That's really the background story for what actually happens. So backing up before all this account to verse 14, now King Herod heard of him. Now this is Jesus. In this account, in Matthew's account, it follows the parables in Matthew chapter 13, the parables of the kingdom. And this is a time of growing popularity. And if the timing is just before the feeding of the 5,000, which both accounts say, this would be about a year before his death and perhaps the peak of Jesus' popularity at this point in time. In Mark's account, it follows the sending out of the disciples, and they return having had, you know, this great success in their mission, power over demons and other things. So it's a time of popularity. So they come to Herod, and they tell him about that. Now, King Herod heard of him, for his name had become well known, and he said, "John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." Why in the world would he think that? You know why, don't you? I just imagine that image of John's head, bloody head on a platter, was in his mind over time. And others said, "No, it's Elijah." Others said, "It's a prophet or like one of the prophets." But when Herod heard, he said, "This is John whom I beheaded." He's insistent. He's not convinced by any of these other theories. And you know, John never did any miracles. But now here's a man doing miracles. And you can imagine Herod thinking, he's back with power now because of what I've done to him. You know it's at work here, don't you? These things in his past, these things that he did that he knew were wrong despite his own depravity, are coming back. And the guilt of his past sin is haunting him. And now yet here's another influence that's confusing his life and making it harder and harder for him to do the right thing. And that's certainly the case for sin in our lives. How many times something we did even as a young man or young woman will remain with us all of our life. And it haunts us. It makes us afraid. We've taken something we shouldn't have taken. Maybe we weren't caught, but you know, every time there's a phone call, oh, this might be it coming back to get me. Have you ever had that experience? I think we all have in our lives things that we just hope they don't come out. And when something happens, we get frightened and say, well, this could be it. Or something bad happens to us and we say, I deserve this because of what terrible things I've done in the past. Have you ever had that feeling in your... Certainly something we all share. What a great reason not to have those bad things in our life, so that in the future we don't have to be afraid that there's some kind of vengeance or some type of return where our guilt comes back to haunt us in some way. The next time we see Herod, actually the last time we actually see him interacting, is at the trials of Jesus. Pilate is interrogating Jesus now. This is about a year later. And he learns that Jesus is from Galilee. And he said, well, you know, Herod is in town. This is kind of fortunate. I will send him over to Herod and see what happens. And so he did that. And when Herod saw Jesus, Luke 23 and verse 8, he was greatly pleased. Don't know if he'd gotten over his fear of this being John the Baptist's return. Perhaps he was greatly pleased because what he saw in front of him was not the image of someone who was going to threaten him. He saw a man who had already been suffering, been beaten, and he was on trial, and he was obviously in his own under the mercy of Herod and Pilate and the soldiers, and he's surrounded by lots of his own men. But he was greatly pleased because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. This is similar to what this thing with John the Baptist had been, where he just liked to hear him. He liked to hear him. In fact, from the time what he had heard about him, he had hoped to see him perform some miracle, verse 8. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. Think about that for a minute. Herod had apparently learned a good bit about what John was had to say. He didn't listen to any of it or didn't obey any of it, but he was interested enough to know. And so he was glad to see Jesus, hoping for some miracle. That would have been fun. That would have been entertaining. But in addition to that, he asked him some questions, lots of questions apparently. But he didn't get any satisfaction. The result was, perhaps showing his power over Jesus at the moment, the chief priests and teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Now here's some of these other pressures on him. Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him and dressed him in an elegant robe and sent him back to Pilate. That day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this they had been enemies. You know what this appearance of the Son of God before Herod turned out to be? Just a little bit of entertainment. An opportunity for something didn't work out. And it also became a chance to maybe get some political advantage in his relationship with Pilate. That's all Jesus meant to him. How many people had an opportunity to have a private audience with both John the Baptist and with Jesus and listen to them and ask them questions? How many people were really in that situation? Some of the disciples, perhaps, that were disciples of John and then became disciples of Jesus. What a great opportunity this man had. And he spoiled it. He wasted it. Thinking of it as only entertainment. Thinking as a curiosity. I think this is typical, too, of sometimes if we're so far in our following of our own lust that our association with Jesus is only for curiosity or some type of worldly advantage. We might even look religious in our pursuits, but is it that our interest in religion is only for curiosity or for worldly advantage? So here are some things we learned from Herod. I want to mention a couple of other times that Herod is mentioned. I think we're going to make 3 points that we should take away from this lesson about looking at a man kind of totally under the power of sin and his own lusts. Back in time again, Mark chapter 8, after the death of John the Baptist, Jesus, and he left them, getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. And then he charged them, this is Jesus, saying, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. It's interesting, in Jesus' teaching to his disciples, he mentions the leaven of Herod. I think we know what the leaven of the Pharisees was. It was this hypocritical worship. This idea that your righteousness was done to be seen of men. We understand that. But what was the leaven of Herod? This may not really be Herod Antipas. It could be Herod the Great. It could be related to this political party the Herodians that wanted to make an alliance with the political power of the day, probably associated with the Sadducees. In fact, if you read Matthew's account of this, he says the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So there's this idea of Sadducees and Herod. What is that? And I think it's the idea of this living a life for power, a life for pleasure, a life that denies the reality of the resurrection and lives your life with that point of view. This life is all there is. You better get whatever you can. Make alliances with evil if you have to, which is what the Sadducees did. I think that's the leaven that Jesus is talking about here. And he's saying, you as disciples, beware of the leaven of this false religion of the Pharisees, but also of this worldly view of religion as a political power, as something that's a matter of convenience, a matter of mixing together your lusts with some outward appearance of religion. How is it that we might have in our lives the leaven of Herod? Well, let's just go back and look at the things that characterized his life. Do our passions make our decisions for us, as opposed to being guided by a single view of the truth? Do we resent a rebuke? Are we willing to accept it without attacking the messenger? Because if we aren't, that's the leaven of Herod. Are we driven by worldly influences and not governed by a single simple desire to do the right thing? We look at our life decisions, where we live, how we spend our money, where we work, the career we've chosen, the friends we've chosen. What governs those? Is it the simple desire to do right, or are all these other factors about what's good for us? What will people think? Do our lusts drive us to increasingly foolish decisions in our life? Are unresolved sins and poor decisions creating unsolvable dilemmas in our lives? And is the guilt of unforgiven sin haunting us? That's the leaven of Herod that Jesus warns about. Is our association with the religion only for expediency or for curiosity? These are things that characterize him. So that's the first lesson. Can we not look at the life of a sinful, foolish man and steer away from those dangers? And these are the things that characterize Herod's life. There's another place where Herod is mentioned, and that's in the book of Luke, chapter 13. On that very day, verse 31, some Pharisees came saying to him, "Get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you." It's not really clear whether that was the case or not, but they threatened Jesus with this idea that Herod's going to kill you, perhaps just as he killed John the Baptist. Maybe that was their logic in that. You know, Jesus kind of discounted that, and he says, "Go tell that fox." And I'll stop and say, why would he call him a fox? A couple of ideas. One is that a fox is kind of tricky. And that's probably why he described him that way. Scheming, deceitful in some way. But you know, a fox is not that courageous either, if you think about foxes. They don't really necessarily attack you like a lion does. So this idea both of trickiness and cowardice probably are both implied in that term. And Jesus called Herod a fox. "Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must journey today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside Jerusalem." What's happened here is that someone has come to threaten Jesus with the evil that's in the world. This man is evil. He might even kill you. And do you notice how frightened Jesus appears with his comment? "Just go tell the fox, I've got work to do." He kind of ignores that. And I think as we look, we look within ourselves to make sure the leaven of Herod is not within our own lives. But then we see the evil in the world and those that would oppose truth and those that would live with the power that they don't deserve to make decisions that are harmful, it seems, to the cause of truth, to righteousness in the world. And we say, how do we deal with that? Does that frighten us? Are we threatened by that? And I think a second lesson, leaven of Herod not in us, but a second lesson is we can't be frightened by that in others as well. We have to do our mission. Jesus says, I have something to do. I have to be perfected. And he's going to go about his mission, really, in a way, ignoring Herod Antipas as a force for evil. There's one other time that Herod is mentioned, and I was surprised to find this. I've forgotten about this reference, if I remembered it. But it's long after Jesus some period of time after Jesus was crucified and had been risen and the church was established. And you remember that Peter and John were arrested after the healing of the lame man. And they were brought in and they were threatened by the leaders of the Jewish faith at that time and told not to teach anymore in the name of Jesus. And then they were released. This is in Acts chapter 4. And they went back to the other Christians then that were gathering there. This was the beginning of the persecution that eventually grew to the stoning of Stephen. In Acts chapter 4, verse 23, and being let go, they went to their own companions and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said to them. So when they had heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, you are God, who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that's in them, who by the mouth of your servant David have said, why the nations rage and the people plot vain things, the kings of the earth take their stand and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and His Christ. And you don't see Herod in there, do you? What's happening is they're offering a prayer to God, saying, you know, we understand that what's happening to us is just a fulfillment of a prophecy that you've made. And they quote the prophecy from Psalm 2. Read on. For truly against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, were gathered together to do whatever your hand and your purpose determined before to be done. Now, Lord, look on their threats and grant to your servants that with all boldness they may speak your word. Do you see that all that Herod did was actually fulfilling God's prophecy? Herod was playing right along in God's plan. Now, he thought he was doing this or that to his own advantage. He thought he was making tricky moves, getting rid of criticism, getting along with his wife in some way. But when you back away, Herod was just a one cog in the machinery of God's plan that was being carried forward that had been prophesied before, long before Jesus even came. He was doing whatever God purposed beforehand to be done. So three applications from Herod. Number one, we have to beware of the leaven of Herod in our life. The power that sin can have over us to do foolish things, to be driven to foolish decisions, to complicate our lives, to be driven by guilt later in life. The second lesson we learn is, however many Herods there are in our world around us, we have a purpose to do today and tomorrow, and then we will be perfected, as Jesus said. And the third thing to learn is that whatever we do, whether we choose the path of Herod or the path of righteousness, we're really working out God's plan. The question just is, which side do you want to be on? The victorious side or the defeated side? Either way, God's plan will prevail. And Herod was nothing more than fulfilling God's plan on this earth. Are you a part of that plan this morning? Get out the invitation song and just be ready to sing that. Would you be free from the burden of sin? Would you over evil a victory win? The first step in conquering sin and its guilt in our lives is to turn our lives over to Jesus, take advantage of the forgiveness that He offers, to get rid of the guilt of our past sin. And then, no longer slaves to sin because of what it has done to us and in us in our life, go forward with a plan that simplifies our life and that single-minded obedience to what He has to say. The waters of baptism are what are the point at which we share in Jesus' death and that sin is taken away. And that's prepared this morning. If you'd like to take advantage of that, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing.